Welcome to the New Books Network.
It had been a long day that Tuesday, October 24th in the year of our Lord, 1871, and it was a blessing for my three Chinese field hands that it was. The day started with bringing in the last of the grapes for the Angelica. My vineyards and winery were my principal support in those days. We had already harvested the Cabernet and the Merlot 2 weeks before, and the wine would soon be ready to move from the vats in which the grapes had fermented into the casks where it would age. The grapes for the Angelica were always harvested last, as they did not ripen readily. Indeed, even when some of the grapes had already turned to raisins, there were still several green grapes among the clusters. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Anne Louise Bannon, author of the Old Los Angeles Mystery Series. In her latest installment, based on a true incident in the history of Los Angeles, 18 Chinese men are lynched in one chaotic night. And Dr. Maddie Wilcox is frustrated that she couldn't stop the violence. She's grateful that her three Chinese field hands are safe, but then one of them is found murdered, and Maddie is attacked. Now, she's not going to let the small-town prejudices stop her from unmasking the murderer. Hi, Anne. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, hi, Louise. I'm so glad to be here.
So I should mention that I got to meet you in person for the first time earlier this year at the Left Coast Crime Festival, in case anyone wondered if bookmarks are worthwhile. You gave me one of your bookmarks and I dove into your world. I loved the first two books in the old LA series and the third one just came out. So
yes.
So that's why I was excited to interview you. You write on your website about how you first got the idea for the old Los Angeles series from a speech your husband gave. Can you explain more about that?
Yeah, that poor man, I swear. No, my husband is the archivist for the city of Los Angeles, and he was doing a talk on the zanja system in Los Angeles, which was how they irrigated the farms and vineyards from way in the early Mexican period all the way up through the, right before the California Aqueduct opened up. This was a, LA being as arid as it is and was, this was a pretty big deal. So the position of Zanjera, which was an official position through about 1911, was the most biggest paid person. He got more money than the mayor did. So Michael's talking about this system. He talked about how, you go out, you pay your subscription to the Zanjero, and then you'd go back, get your receipt, and then the Zanjero's men would come out and open up the sluice gates, and the water would rush into your zanja or ditch. And I'm thinking, well, I write murder mysteries. What a great time for a body to pop up. And I have to say, Michael was a little perturbed that I got a body out of his talk, but he did go with it. God bless him.
When I interview mystery authors, which is a new thing for me, I try to stay away from discussing characters that might or might not be red herrings. But we can probably talk about your protagonist.
Oh, sure.
Do you see yourself at all in Maddie? Can you tell us about Maddie Wilcox?
I would imagine she has certain of my characteristics. She does tend to be very liberal, especially for that time. But her voice is that of Louisa May Alcott. She is a woman of her time. She's a very Victorian prim lady, always will be a lady. That she does love clothes. That probably is a little bit more in common with me. She was just an interesting person. I it was kind of weird after I had that talk with my husband. It was weird how she started coming to life. And then I started hearing her voice. And that she is kind of she's a little interesting for a major protagonist in that she isn't as much like me as some of my other protagonists are.
She's a cool character, I will say. I really enjoyed your descriptions of what everyone wore, the fabrics, the stitching, the styles. What kind of research did that require?
a costume history class back in my undergrad days. Well, that's the start of it. I've always had I love historical clothing. And one of the fun things about 1870, you know, the time from 1869 to about early 1870s, this was the transition from the hoop skirt to the bustle. And if you look at pictures, and I do have a couple costume history books because I like that sort of thing. And if you look at the pictures, you can actually see the big round hoop skirts evolving into a bustle in the back. Mm. And that's a lot of fun. You know, researching the fabrics and, you know, it's a fun era for fashion, I have to say. And I love fashion. So, and I love clothing history.
Okay. So Maddie treats her workers, wherever they're from, as friends, even going so far as to have them call her by her first name. How would that have gone over with the townspeople back in the 1870s?
Oh, it wouldn't have at all. Women called their husbands Mr. so-and-so by their last name. They didn't always refer to them, you know, depending on the situation. But no, people did not use first names, at least among the Anglo population. I'm not so sure about the Hispanic, but I would imagine it was fairly, formal. And so the fact that she does, well, it started out as an accident. You know, she'd call for Señor Ortiz, and whichever, you know, and then there are two Señor Ortizes on the farm, Sebastiano and Enrique. And so it's like inevitably the one she didn't want was the one who answered. So she just says, all right, Sebastiano, Enrique. And by death of the city marshal, they're actually partners. She's decided, okay. And that would have caused a bit of a scandal because you didn't refer to, you know, the Anglos and the Hispanics didn't mix as much as they do now. I mean, it was very common to have white men marrying Mexican women, but there weren't a lot of white women around. Governor John Downey was married to Maria Downey, who was a Hispanic. John Downey being one of the first governors of California. Marshal Warren, who is in Death of the City Marshal, he was married to Juana Lopez, which was a very large family. So there was a lot of intermarriage, but it wasn't, you know, there wasn't as much mixing between the classes. It was still very, you know, there are them.
Mm-hmm. Maddie Wilcox drinks wine with nearly every meal. And I'm wondering if you do that too. I also read that you give classes about wine. So can you talk about that, especially the Angelica wine that Maddie loves so much?
Oh, I can talk all day about Angelica. I don't have wine with every meal. In fact, I very seldom have it before 5 o'clock at night, but we do generally drink wine after dinner. My husband, my wonderful husband, is a home winemaker. In addition to being a home winemaker, as in we get lots of wine at home, he also, as archivist, works with the El Pueblo Monument. It's just the state monument for the oldest part of Los Angeles, which you do see a lot of in the books because it was it was the plaza. It was one of the more prominent spots in town at the time. Excuse me. Anyway, so there is the oldest building in Los Angeles was built around 1818. It's the Avila Adobe. It's in the middle of what's called Olvera Street. It was Wine Street back in the day. And there are these two vines there that are mission vines that are direct, but Michael has since found out are directly related to two mission vines at the San Gabriel Mission in San Gabriel, California. And so being more or less friends with the director of the El Pueblo Monument, he asked him, hey, can I take some of these grapes and make wine with them? And the guy said, sure. And Michael got a professional winemaker and friend of ours, Wes Hagen, to help with the pruning, and another lovely lady, Dorothy, oh God, why am I blanking on her last name all of a sudden? Anyway, Gypsy Canyon. And she was making Angelica based on old mission recipes that she'd gotten from Santa Barbara Mission, because she's up that way, and had found about an acre, just a whole bunch of these old mission vines growing on her property from the 1880s or 1890s. Well, Michael's looking at these things, and he's thinking they've been there since at least the 1860s. These are some of the oldest vines in the state. So Michael collected those grapes and decided, well, I'm going to make what they made back then, and that was Angelica. One of the reasons, it's basically a sherry, which is not surprising given that, you know, this was the Spanish put this in, and Xerez, of course, is sherry, which is Spanish. So it's basically a fortified wine, which was very necessary in the hot climate for preserving it. And fortified means there's extra alcohol or brandy in. So Michael started making this stuff, and it came out really nicely. And it's kind of fun because when Maddie's complaining about, you know, in the beginning of Death of the Chinese Field Hands, that the grapes don't all ripen at once. I know that from personal experience.
Right. Okay.
You know, so Michael goes and, you know, harvests the grapes, and he may be actually doing it again in a couple of weeks. I forget when.
Wow. This year, 2020, has been a terrible year for California in terms of the fires and for growers in particular, with hopes that we clean up our planet, California gets the help it needs to combat these ever more disastrous fires. Can you share a bit about Oddball Grape? It's a section on your website in which you make recommendation for wines that have been affected by fire. Everyone wants to know.
Well, first off, if you do get a wine that tastes like an ashtray, yeah, that's smoke taint. We do have some problems with that. Oddball Grape, unfortunately, is kind of on hiatus right now. Michael's in grad school, and it's a team project between Michael and me. But we wanted to do wine education, but we wanted to do it with a very personality-based. And I wanted to feature women and people of color who are busy making wine, because they don't get the press that the white guys do. And so that's why the direction we went. It's just that, you know, we got busy and weren't able to post as much, but we still have some fun things up there. I think there's a fairly recent post on the whole Riedel, do you really need different shaped glasses for each wine kind of thing.
Do you?
No.
Okay.
It's a total ripoff. There's only one glass that really affects it, and that's the big, it's what they call a Burgundy or Pinot glass, and it's the one with the big bowl and the narrow opening. And that's, you know, it looks like basically a brandy stifter on a long stem. And that is because you get more aeration, you got more surface area of the wine for the aromatics to escape, and there's not as big a hole for them to escape out of. So when you put your nose in that glass, it's very rich.
Wow. So you also offer classes on soap making and various aspects of writing and marketing. So my question is, when do you find time to write? And what's your process?
Oh, the process will vary every now and then. When I find time to write, I make time. Actually, right now, I'm kind of there's one of my other series that I think you want to talk about in a few minutes, the Operation Quickline one. That was a series I actually wrote in the 1980s, and now I'm rewriting, and the dang thing has hijacked my brain, and that's all I want to work on. That's all I want to do. I am stopping now. I mean, it's still up on my computer, and I can read the next line I was going to be writing. My process will vary depending on a variety of different things. Usually I'll get an idea. The characters will start talking to me. It's a very noisy place in my head. And then what'll happen is I'll probably write down a few chapters. I have to know who done it, especially if it's a mystery. I have to know where the story's going. But then I'll usually start a few graphs, and then all of a sudden I'll realize I can't get any further unless I have everything all plotted out. And then I'll start working on my outline, and then I'll start, and then I'll start just writing. And I'm kind of in the middle of that on forget what number book this one is in the Operation Quickline one, but I've just done. Earlier this spring, I finished the sequel to the most recently published. The most recently published, of course, is Sad Lisa, and I've just finished These Hallowed Halls. And then I've got My Sweet Lisa, that got that one done, Little Family Business done, and now I'm in Just Because You're Paranoid, and I've lost count.
Wait, well, since we're talking about Operation Quickline, and the reason you knew I was going to ask, because I asked you if it was okay if I asked about it. What are those about? Are they mysteries? And also, how do you decide which series to work on at any given time?
I actually technically should be doing a one-off that I've been planning for weeks and months. That's what I should be working on right now. And I'm not. It's because this one just hijacked my brain. That's not that common. How I decide is it's a combination of instinct and interest. The idea starts happening and, wow, I really want to play this one out. So as far as Operation Quickline, it's actually probably more of a romance with espionage intrusions than anything else. When I originally conceived it and Lisa Wycherly and Sid Hackerburn started coming to life, it really was interested in the interplay between a woman who has very, very strict values. She believes in sex is reserved for marriage. She's a practicing Catholic, and she comes up and is not forced, but finds herself working with this guy who is an atheist, who believes in free love. I mean, and all of a sudden she's a spy, and it's like, okay, what do I do? And literally the first line of the first book is, my name is Lisa Wycherly. I live with my boss. I'm not sleeping with him. He has enough women in and out of his bedroom. He doesn't need me. Lord, that sounds defensive. And she's really trying to figure out who she is. And she's trying to figure out how she ended up in this spot. And the fact is, there is a decided attraction between the two. I mean, I really had to work. Sid was really an interesting character for me because on one hand, I wanted him to be really sexy and just really free and loose. On the other hand, I didn't want him to be sleazy because that would just be gross. And actually, it wouldn't be that attractive to Lisa anyway. And so I really set him up. He was raised literally by a bunch of hippies and beatniks and communists. And so he believes in free love. Sex is just a normal, basic thing you do. And, and it's all about the joy and the fun and everything like that. And in one of the later books, he literally comments, in some ways, Lisa, who says no, period, places just as high a value on sexual activity as I do. For her, it's something sacred. For me, it's something to be indulged in. And it's really kind of an interesting dichotomy. And again, it's Darn Sorry has turned out to be much more about the relationship than it did about the espionage.
Interesting. How long does it take you from the time you get the idea until your book is ready for release?
At least a year or two. The actual writing doesn't take that long. The mulling over takes considerably longer. I tend to be one of those people, I have to write everything in my head first before I put it on the screen. And so I'll be doing a lot of what does not look like writing, and then all of a sudden, clack, 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 clack. So it takes a while. Also, once I'm done with a first or second draft, I like to set it aside for a while, let it marinate, let it stew, and then go back to it and say, oh, shoot, I effed that up. Oh, my God, there's a plot hole. Oh, my God.
Okay.
And that takes a little bit of time, too. So, and then, of course, the release process, I try to get things ready to go about 6 months before they're actually out.
I also read one of the books in the Freddie and Kathy series, which is pleasingly set in my hometown of Chicago. First, can you tell me the story about how the series started? And second, will we hear again from Kathy and Freddie?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I thought it was in New York City. There's a couple scenes in Chicago, I think.
Well, those are the ones I remember.
Freddie and Kathy, that was kind of a fun one. That actually did. I had had a dream, and for some reason, the image of a theater marquee with a Model T. This is set in the 1920s in New York. And the theory, I saw this. And then, Freddie started talking to me. And it was right around that time I was literally baking a cheesecake for a party of some sort. And I had on my CD player, one of our first CDs, the Ella Fitzgerald singing the George and Ira Gershwin songbook with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. And if you ever want to get a terrific CD, that's the one to get. It's just fabulous.
I know that CD well.
I love it. So there's Ella singing Fascinating Rhythm. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, I'm dancing along and slap the cheesecake. Or just a bunch of the cheesecake landed on the floor.
Not savable.
It was just a little of the cheesecake, but it was. And as I'm cleaning the mess up and getting the cheesecake actually into the oven, it occurs to me, Fascinating Rhythm is a song about obsession. Yeah, and it just, the wheels started turning and turning and turning. And sure enough, and then on top of that, I actually was riding my bike, got hit by a car and landed on my elbow. And so I had this broken right elbow. And I was bored and I'm watching, well, shoot, I could do some 1920s research. I can watch, AMC was broadcasting a lot of stuff. So I watched The Sheik with Rudolph Valentino. I watched Wings, which, by the way, is a hell of a good film. So I was watching some of the silent films from the era too. And all of a sudden everything started coalescing. Mm-hmm. And I wrote Fascinating Rhythm. I actually did cranked the first draft out. Now I've done a lot of rewrites on it since, but I cranked the first draft out. In 2 weeks, because I didn't have anything else I was doing. I was recovering from this broken elbow. Mm. And of course, Kathy and Freddie had to keep talking to me, darn them. And next thing I know, I'm writing Bring Into Bondage. So,
do you know offhand how many books you've published altogether?
Published about 12, 13, 14.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's published. I mean, I had a bad first marriage, okay? So I did a lot of writing in the mid to late 80s, early 90s. So hey, I got a wonderful kid out of it, so I'm not complaining too much.
Okay. Another question. Why did you decide to self-publish rather than going the traditional route?
I had been trying to do the traditional route. And no matter what, everybody liked stuff, but they didn't like it enough, which was really frustrating. Mm-hmm. And then I had a friend who had written a really, really good book. I didn't know how good it was when she did, but she was saying how she wanted to self-publish because she was looking at all the hassle of getting the agent, getting the publisher, and getting rejected, and all the other hassles, and the fact that even after it got published, she still would have to do all the publicity and all the other work. And I'm sitting here going, she's right. She's right. Shavings. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. I mean, and the really reality is you're doing almost all the work that anyway. And I says, screw this. I'm not giving them and only getting 40, like 20% of what I work my arse off for.
A 20% might be high.
Yeah.
I think like $1 per ebook and I don't know.
Oh, it's something ridiculous, you know? And I sat there and said, why am I doing all the, if I'm doing all this work promoting, writing, paying an editor anyway, heck with this. I'm doing it myself. And it was tough. It was quite a learning curve, but it's been worth it so far. The hard part is there's just so much out there and it's really hard getting noticed. So
I hear you. So now you said you were starting, you were on an Operation Quickline series book, but what's happening for you next? What are you working on next? What can we expect to see?
What can you expect to see? Well, I do. The fun thing with the Operation Quickline stories is that I do blog them on my website. I have an ongoing one right now called White House Rhapsody, kind of a straight romantic fiction. I'm a little torn between whether I'm going to put up these Hallett Halls, which is the next Operation Quickline one, Or a time travel novel that I wrote and have rewritten a couple of times called But World Enough in Time. So I don't know if that's going to be next, but that's probably what you're going to see next. I have a book that has been edited. I just have to go ahead and produce it, and it's a contemporary called Rage Issues. So I'm thinking that may be my spring release coming up. And then I'm also working on another manuscript that the one I thought I was going to be working on this semester. And I'm like, oops, working on Quicklime instead. And that's called Running Away to Boston. That's kind of a techno, I hope, thriller.
How do you find an audience when your books are of so many different genres?
That I have no idea. But the thing is, I am the ADD poster child. Asking me to stick to one thing is not going to happen. I've been trying for 60 odd years. It ain't happening, folks. So, it's who I am. It's part and parcel of it. And, you know, I'll find an audience some way. There'll be people who will love, you know, the old Los Angeles series and hate Quicklime. There are people who think, oh, God, I love Freddie and Kathy. They're terrific and hate old Los Angeles series. I'm past worrying about it. I just, it's what I am. It's what I do. And I'm not going to use a pen name. I don't really want to. So.
Okay. I like your attitude. Mm-hmm. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck. And I'd like to be informed when the next old Los Angeles book comes out. And I'm also interested in Freddie and Kathy, and maybe I'll have to start the other one.
So. Okay. Well, I have to be honest. I don't think the earlier Quicklime ones are as good as the others. They've just gotten a lot better. Sad Lisa really came out well. But,
I'll expect some guidance from you on what to read. Thanks so much for spending time with me today, Anne.
Well, thank you, Galit. It was lovely. I'm having a blast. This is great.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Anne Louise Bannon, author of Death of the Chinese Field Hands, the third book in her old Los Angeles mystery series. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As New Book Network listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.